The headlines: Lebanon's president gives his approval to deal with what will settle a maritime dispute with the Israeli regime. Russia is pledging to take adequate countermeasures if the U.S. and other Western states continue to escalate the situation in Ukraine. Plus, a senior U.S. senator is urging the government to freeze security cooperation with Saudi Arabia following a decision by OPEC+. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Lebanon has reportedly approved the final draft of a deal with Israel that seeks to patch up Beirut's maritime dispute with the regime over a gas field in the Mediterranean. Lebanon's presidential office says the draft meets Lebanon's demands and protects its rights to natural wealth. The maritime agreement paves the way for exploration of offshore natural gas reserves by Lebanon. Energy Minister Waleed Fayad said that it will make Lebanon a petrostate. Israel has also described the agreement as historical. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah is yet to react, but has said earlier that it would agree to the Lebanese government's stance on achieving a maritime deal with Israel. Hezbollah has also warned the regime against looting Lebanon's natural resources. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent Mariam Saleh from Beirut. Mariam, walk us through the details of this deal and whether it incorporates all of Lebanon's demands and guarantees its gas exploration rights.
Well, of course, this is a very significant step for Lebanon. It's also significant for President Michel Aoun, who began his term by actually signing contracts with energy companies, making it the first time for Lebanon to sign such contracts. And now he is basically ending his term with this agreement, which is very significant. In order for us to put this into perspective, to understand this better, Lebanon has for 11 years been demanding that we demarcate our maritime borders based on line 23. Of course, then the Israelis, even the so-called U.S. mediators, had refused completely. They wanted to take us back down to the so-called Hoffline, the first U.S. mediator who came to Lebanon, and to remove that right from Lebanon. But Lebanon continued to stress on that right, and there is even a ratified bill in the parliament to say that Lebanon should demarcate based on line 23. The Americans and the Israelis did not just stress and refuse. They even stopped negotiations altogether. And that was what led, of course, Lebanon to a crisis, U.S. sanctions. They even threatened petroleum companies like Total and even Russian company that they will be enforcing sanctions on them if they do come under Lebanese waters. So what we're seeing here is something that has happened after the resistance warning, and we even saw drones from the resistance. We heard this from Hezbollah Secretary General stressing that Hezbollah will not allow the Israeli entity to drill in the Karish field until the dispute is finalized, until Lebanon demarcates its borders, and until Lebanon has the full right to drill. So we have three main issues here. Number one is that we have a deal. It's been very discreet, of course, but we know some details. We know that Lebanon will be given definitely 923, and Lebanon will also be given a potentially rich field called the Kana field, which goes beyond line 23. It's not just line 23, so we have something line 23 plus. In addition to that, we have assigned a confirmation from the United States that Lebanon may begin immediately to drill in its waters, and no one will come near that right, and no one will stop that right. So these are three very significant issues that we do know from sources, of course. This has been translated by a meeting today between Prime Minister Najib Mikati, the Energy Minister Fayad, who met with representatives of the French petroleum company Total, and they have asked the company to begin directly to drill in Lebanese waters. So this is very significant for Lebanon. It's actually a historic date for Lebanon. And of course, this awaits when it comes to the actual demarcation. We are awaiting a certain ratification from the Lebanese parliament, but the president will be meeting, of course, also with the prime minister, the speaker of the parliament, in order to make things more official. However, this has been the result, if you may say, of continuous warnings from the resistance. And it is the first time, and as we hear from Israeli media, that this is the first time that the Israelis actually succumb to certain demands from a single Arab state and accept its demands for Line 23, which was something that we saw 11 years ago as almost impossible. And we will hear, of course, today from Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah his remarks or his comments on this, but he has stressed before that the resistance is totally behind the official stance, they are behind the government. Whatever the government stresses on, then the resistance will accept, of course. But as long as there was a dispute, as long as Lebanon was not allowed to drill in its waters or in economic fields, then the Israelis would not be allowed to. So the Israelis felt that this warning was quite plausible, was very truthful. And so this is why we believe that the Israelis succumbed and accepted those demands from Lebanon's side.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, live from Beirut. Iran's foreign ministry has once again summoned the British ambassador to express its strong condemnation of the UK's, quote, interventions in Iran's internal affairs. The foreign ministry said Iran considers Britain's arbitrary sanctions as totally worthless and reserves the right to take reciprocal action. The UK imposed sanctions on Iran over what it called the violation of human rights during recent riots in the country. The UK sanctions target a number of Iranian police, political, and security officials. The blacklisting will bar these individuals from traveling to the UK. The bans came after similar sanctions by the U.S. Iran has slammed Washington's move by calling it a backbone of American-style human rights. Journalist and activist Fra Hughes earlier told us that the sanctions are not so much punishing Iran as publicity stunts.
I think it's obvious to anyone who watches and pays attention to the politics of the region that this is yet another color revolution being sown by the CIA and by MI6, probably the French and the Israelis. What they're trying to do, the sanctions are designed not really to punish Iran in any major way with this particular set of sanctions. This is more propaganda to be put in the newspapers, to be digested by the internal kind of civilian population within America and Britain, to paint Iran as a country that violates human rights, that is some type of theocracy that uses religious laws in order to oppress its people. It's pure propaganda. It's being used in order to create a narrative that would make Iran a pariah, and it's there to give political cover to the riots which we have seen, the violent riots which we have seen in Iran. We've seen this all before. We've seen this in Syria, I believe it was in 2011, in Daraa, where the Western media were portraying a public kind of people-led revolution against Bashar al-Assad's government as a generic kind of build-up of opposition to the government. But again, that was financed, armed, and directed by America and Saudi Arabia and other Western imperialist interests.
Russia has vowed to respond to Western countries' growing involvement in the Ukraine conflict. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov is warning that the U.S. and NATO should realize, in his own words, the danger of uncontrolled escalation in Washington and other Western capitals. Rybakov made the comments after Washington and its Western allies said they will continue support for Ukraine. U.S. President Joe Biden has vowed to provide Ukraine with advanced air defense systems. He made the pledge after Russia conducted its largest missile attack against Ukraine since the start of the war. Washington has been a key supplier of arms to Ukraine since the beginning of the war with Russia in February. The value of the U.S. military aid stands at close to $17 billion. The French government threatens to intervene to end a week-long refinery strike that have led to major fuel shortages across the country. Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire says the government will not allow the blockades on refineries to last. The government also says striking workers could be asked to return to work. The individual action, the industrial action, that is, over the workers' payment, has taken 60% of French refining capacity offline. This has led to fuel shortage in a third of gas stations nationwide, where long lines are formed. The strike action has refineries. It has hit refineries, that is, run by Total Energies and ExxonMobil. The walkout has worsened the energy crisis and inflation in France due to the Russia's war in Ukraine. The European Commission announced plans for Ukraine to join the EU's long-term budget, suggesting the Ukrainian government would receive 3.5 billion euros every month to keep the state functioning. Meanwhile, the EU's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, warns the world is heading for a recession due to rising inflation and interest rates. Jerome Hughes reports.
The 2022 EU Ambassadors Conference was launched on Monday in Brussels against the backdrop of the war in Ukraine and its global consequences. Ambassadors from the EU's 145 delegations and offices around the world took part.
This is a perfect storm. First, prices increasing. Everybody's running to increase interest rates. This will bring us to a world recession.
Tensions between the West and Russia are rising. One official in Moscow claims a truck was used to attack the Crimean bridge last Saturday and had travelled through EU nation Bulgaria. The European Commission was asked to respond.
There are so many things coming out of Moscow and from these official so-called places which don't really merit any commentary. I mean, let me recall that the Crimea is Ukraine.
No one has yet claimed responsibility, but some analysts say the move was a strategic mistake.
The threats of a nuclear conflict are becoming more and more real. And I think it wasn't wise, it was really provocative to attack the bridge, especially military. Whoever did it, they haven't reached any significant result because the bridge resumed functioning the very same day.
12 months ago, EU agency the European Court of Auditors determined Ukraine is corrupt to the core. Despite this, the nation is set to become part of the EU's long-term budget. The European Commission says Kiev needs 3.5 billion euro per month to run the country.
Since the beginning of the war, we have supported Ukraine financially with, as Team Europe, with up to 19 billion euros. This is not including the military capability and equipment support.
Fighting intensified on Monday as Russia's military struck Kiev and other Ukrainian cities. The latest position from the West's perspective is due to become clearer later this week when a meeting of NATO defence ministers takes place here in the Belgian capital. Also, an EU leaders' summit is due to take place here at the end of next week. Analysts are not anticipating there will be many references made to peace talks. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
According to the Italian Central Bank's latest reports, firms see the economic situation in Italy as deteriorating. This as the government has already spent more than 60 billion euros to protect the country's economy.
A study presented by the Bank of Italy on Monday raised the alarm on the Italian company's sentiment on the future. According to the report, based on information gathered between August 15 and September 15, spiraling inflation and uncertainty linked to the conflict in Ukraine have badly dented optimism. The Bank of Italy surveyed companies in the industrial and service sectors with at least 50 employees.
Bank of Italy's data was somehow predictable. One just needs to talk to people to realize how worrying the situation is. Maybe we must be aware that the financialization of the economy, a long-standing issue, is aggravating the economic situation and that companies must stop seeking high profits in a short span of time.
A third of the firms surveyed said difficulties related to rising energy costs had worsened in the previous 3 months, sparking a downward revision in the investment plans for the remainder of the year. The war between Ukraine and Russia has made an Italian energy crisis much worse. Italy received 40% of its gas imports before the conflict from Russia.
Assistiamo a un'impennata dei prezzi.
We are witnessing a spike in energy prices, which is only partially due to a shortage of supplies, and also has roots in speculative strategies which threaten thousands of companies and alarm families.
The leader of a right-wing coalition that won elections about 2 weeks ago, Giorgia Meloni, is likely to become Italy's next prime minister. Meloni will face no shortage of challenges, from the budget and recovery plans to finding unity with allies and deciding how to handle the Ukraine-Russia war. So far, the Mario Draghi's government has spent 66 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs. Italy's finances are set to be further put to the test, as analysts predict the next government will be forced to increase fiscal aid or even to resort to a budgetary slippage. Max Civilli, Rome.
Calls are growing louder in the U.S. Congress to punish Saudi Arabia over its decision to lower oil production and raise prices. A senior U.S. senator is now calling for an immediate freeze on cooperation with the kingdom, including most arms sales. Senator Bob Menendez says the U.S. must limit arms sales and security cooperation to what is absolutely necessary to defend U.S. personnel and interests. Three U.S. legislators have already included a bill to withdraw troops and missile defense systems from Saudi Arabia. The kingdom is the largest oil producer in OPEC Plus. The oil alliance has announced an output cut by 2 million barrels per day from November. That could push up gasoline prices in the U.S. ahead of the midterm elections next month. It also hinders U.S. efforts to restrict Russia's oil revenue over the war in Ukraine. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing European security polarization and the new Cold War against Russia with Professor Heinz Gettner from the University of Vienna. But first, this brief analysis.
Decades of aggressive eastward expansion by US-led NATO towards the borders of the Russian Federation following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the aftershocks of the Russian invasion of Ukraine have led to a dramatic security polarization in Europe, not seen since the height of the Cold War in the mid-20th century. The dreams of a borderless Europe from the Ural Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean seem very naive these days, as a hard border is being established between the Russian Federation and neighboring European countries, with a dramatic increase in the level of militarization on both sides, which, if history is to be guide, will not be dismantled very quickly once it's firmly established. Even the previously non-aligned countries of Sweden and Finland have joined NATO. It seems the old British plan of preventing a strategic alignment between Russia and Europe, and particularly between Russia and Germany, is once again being implemented. However, this time this effort is being led by Britain's American cousins, who inherited the British Empire following World War II. It's precisely in the period of the so-called American unipolar moment in the late 1990s and early 21st century, where the world witnessed the aggressive expansion of NATO towards the western borders of Russia. the instrumentalization of Ukraine, the weaponization of Ukrainian nationalism against Russia and Russian speakers in Ukraine, and the threat of Ukrainian NATO membership was the final straw and repeatedly stated red line that pushed Russia to take preemptive military action against NATO expansion into Ukraine. The severe reactions and sanctions by the Western countries against Russia have led Russia to strategically reorient itself towards the east and southeast, towards China and Iran. This has been very beneficial for Eurasian integration and particularly for boosting Iran-Russia relations. And it represents a very significant historic and geostrategic shift. But the question remains whether it's in the national interests of European countries to have bad political and economic relations with Russia. Is it really in the interests of many European nations to sanction and vilify their most important energy and raw material supplier and one of their largest export markets? Despite historically high inflation, the threat of closure of major industries, and exponential rises in energy costs, brainwashed Atlanticist European elites continue to repeat the anti-Russian propaganda designed in US and NATO think tanks, contrary to what many of the citizens believe, which is neutrality and non-alignment based on the real, tangible interests of nations. Of course, the people of Europe have so far received their reply from their elites. As for example, when the young, inexperienced German foreign minister proudly announced that helping Ukraine is more important than what German voters want. It remains to be seen how she and her party will fare the next time German voters get to vote on what they want. Cracks are already appearing in the European facade as nations such as Hungary and Serbia are trying to take an independent position based on their national interests vis-a-vis Russia, as well as countries such as Austria, who are warning about the consequences of unilateral energy sanctions and trying to moderate the anti-Russian rhetoric. But in general, it seems that nearly all European elites have once again shown their geopolitical impotence and inability to form policies independent from US and NATO diktats. As we head into this year's cold winter in Europe, we will have to see how much the European people are willing to sacrifice from their high standards of living in the pursuit of this new Cold War against Russia, which has divided Europe and forced a major historic and geopolitical realignment in the world, and which, contrary to US and NATO propaganda, does not appear to be in Europe's long-term interests.
Professor Heinz Gärtner, Professor of Political Science, University of Vienna, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
You're welcome.
When we heard that you're coming to Tehran, we asked you to come join us in person for this interview. You kindly replied to this request, so here we are. We want to talk, as you know, the program Insight is really a program where we try to look at things strategically. We try to get a deeper understanding of what's going on. And one of the major issues of the world today is what the events that are happening in Europe, particularly the events that have now occurred with the war in Ukraine. And it seems that there is a new security architecture, a new security structure, a new reality that has descended upon Europe, a reality which in many ways is very similar to the Cold War. You have this hard border again being drawn between Europe and Russia. You have countries that even during the Cold War, like Finland and Sweden, who weren't part of NATO, are joining NATO. But here we have to then look at really again this bad faith that we see from the West and from the Americans, which is, so you have this Ukraine after the Soviet Union, which has a significant Russian-speaking population, culturally Russian population. And then they do the Maidan coup. They bring in these neo-Nazi groupings that are part of this coalition. We don't want to say that they were the main people, but they were a significant part. And you change the constitution. They get rid of the Russian language as part of the constitutional rights of the Russian people. You have the civil war starting in 2014. So, yes, I mean, your point is well taken that this would have been a good situation. But it seems to me that the last thing that the Americans or NATO wanted is a Ukraine where people are living together in peace. They actually were provoking the Russians in many ways with the attacks that they did particularly on the Russian population. And then when the NATO membership was mentioned, again, we are trying to analyze. We're not trying to justify or to agree or disagree with whatever decision was made in Russia, but it is understandable from an analytical perspective if the Russians felt like there was no other option left for them, because they tried all the political options and it seemed, whether it was the Minsk agreements, whatever, all the other political and diplomatic formulas and ways to deal with this, they saw it was not happening. And maybe this is something going back to the essence of Ukraine. You have this country being created, as you mentioned, and Henry Kissinger mentioned a long time ago, that you have actually two
March
Ukraines.
2014.
Exactly. that you have actually two Ukraines. It's not one country. You have this Ukraine in the West, which is Catholic and much more culturally closer to Poland and that part of Europe. And then you have the East, which is culturally closer to Russia. Mm. So what I want to say, because you mentioned these very interesting things, so what you're saying is that essentially we've had this historic turn, this historic event happening, where Russia is separated from Europe, where it separated itself, if we want to analyze it from that perspective, or the Europeans decided with the Americans to separate themselves from the Russians. Mm. In Iran, of course, we would say that this was good for us, because then Russia came towards the Asian side, came closer to China, became closer to Iran. As we see, there's very extensive an increase of relations between Iran and Russia in this time. So maybe geopolitically for Asia or Eurasia, this was better. But again, my question is it really in the national interests of a lot of these European countries to have this cordon sanitaire, this hard border? If you look at Hungary, it's trying to have some sort of an independent policy with Russia. It's not, in terms of, at least rhetorically and in terms of the way they speak, they are being a little bit more cautious in terms of their relation with Russia. You see even Austria, in many ways, trying to maintain its neutrality within this idea of what's going on, this alliance building, as you say. We see, of course, Serbia, traditionally a natural ally of the Russians, culturally close to the Russians, basically saying that they will not join NATO, no matter what. So again, my question is, as a European, I'm asking you, is it really in many of these countries, particularly those who are closer to Russia, who are maybe dependent in terms of energy and gas and coal and raw materials, is it really in their interest to be in a Cold War and a kind of a non-relation state with Russia?
Let me make two points. First point, briefly, we don't have that much time anymore.
No, go ahead.
So to Ukraine, I have to say Russia was not really fond of neutrality either. So Russia said that I would be in. They would support a non-NATO membership of NATO, which was credible, I would think. Every Russian president repeated that. Mm-hmm. But they did not really speak about neutrality. They didn't really. Because that meant the Russian supported militias in the east.
Right. That means Russia would also have to.
Well, Russia would have. It would be an example also for Moldova and Georgia, where you have Russian troops or peacekeepers. Right. However. Right. So it would be a model for others as well. So the Russians would not really support neutrality. And I have to say, if Ukraine would have become neutral, it could get its territorial sovereignty and territorial integrity back. So it's a unified, you mentioned it's divided. The Russians might have speculated that they want somehow keep the eastern part.
Right.
But if there would have been a neutral Ukraine, all foreign powers would have to leave, and Ukraine would have the possibility, like Austria, to create its own identity. Right. Sovereignty.
In other words, nobody wanted a neutral Ukraine, neither NATO and neither
unfortunately,
Russia.
Unfortunately, you're right.
Exactly.
Some supported it, right. So like Henry Kissinger and Mearsheimer as well. They came later as well with the suggestion. So there are some pundits who really thought that it might be the best. But politically, you're correct. Politically, you're correct. So your second point, do the Europeans really want to have this divided Europe? So, and I have to say no. So
exactly.
Because now Putin brought war, and Putin and NATO brought the division
right.
of Europe back, like in the Cold War. But that was our starting point. Now it plays out like in this polarization. We have a division of Europe, cordon sanitaire. It even goes to the cultural level. So
it's ridiculous. Some of the sanctions are ridiculous. Sports, culture, opera singers,
arts, science.
It's ridiculous.
To talk to Russian scientists.
We were joking in Iran that it's even worse than the sanctions against Iran, which we thought would never happen.
I don't know whether I could speak on Russian TV like I speak here.
right.
Yeah. So we have this new coordinator summit there, and it will last decades. And the Europeans cannot want to have this.
Exactly.
So they have to think about it, maybe not immediately, but we do have concepts from the history which it could be applied.
So let's talk about that a little.
So I just mentioned two of them.
Right.
So one is because I'm coming from Vienna. We had the Vienna Congress of 1815.
Exactly.
We had
yes.
the Napoleonic Wars, and then the victory powers would sit together, and they would ask France to come to the table a little bit later on as
right.
well, and created an order for Europe, which was peaceful first half a century, and then we had this wars of unification, another Crimean war, but then it lasted another half century after the first war. So it was based on balance of power, at the same time on liberal concepts, common values. I have to say, there were all colonial powers. So their interventions right. in the south, that was permitted.
Exactly. That was part
that
of
was the caveat of this. But for Europe, it was not such a bad concept to sit together and to avoid another war, which was successful, at least half a century, you can say.
Right.
Then you had this war. So Europeans should think about it. Is this type applicable to have a big conference when the war is over, to think about it? We have to somehow bring in Russia back to Europe.
Right.
Like Europe did it after the Second World War with the Marshall Plan. After the First World War, they isolated Germany. And
didn't work.
The result was Hitler.
Exactly.
The Nazis, no?
Exactly. So after World War II, they had the Marshall Plan trying to bring
in. And then the second concept I would like to mention is during the height of the Cold War, we had a conference on security
exactly.
and cooperation, the Helsinki Accords
exactly.
of 75. And this was an interesting concept. Height of the Cold War, we had the arms race, of course, we had at the same time the German Ostpolitik and also the the Detente-Politik by President Nixon. It was all a global context,
exactly.
of course. But
exactly.
it was the Helsinki Conference. And if you look at the Helsinki documents, they do not mention the words enemy, foe, competitor, rival.
Right.
If you look at the security strategies right now,
yeah,
they are all full of this. And why, and it speaks about common security, cooperative security, and why is it interesting theoretically? So we talked about the security dilemma before. Because security, if we make a decision, security, the other one would react somehow. That would be, I increase my security and the other would feel
right.
it offensive. And so the idea was not to increase the security, but to lower the threat level.
Exactly.
A common security is the opposite of the security dilemma.
Right.
Common security was also the idea of the Palme Commission later
right,
on.
Right.
Willy Brandt, Palme, Kreisky, so they had this, this idea.
Yes.
So this lower the threat and not increase my military capacity.
And they were all social democrats. Olaf Palme, Willy Brandt, Bruno Kreisky.
I have to mention this. The one who really prevented the neutral Central Europe in the 50s, according to the Austrian model, there were ideas, Western pundits, not Stalin. So it was George Kennan as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was Labour Party leader Hugh Gaitskell, it was the bipartisan initiative, Noland Humphrey from the US, they all said, Rabatsky Plan, Polish foreign minister, they wanted to create a neutral Central Europe, a nuclear weapon free,
right,
with the inclusion of Germany. Germany would be unified, but it was also Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary would not part of the Warsaw Pact. So the one who really was opposed it was Konrad Adenauer, etc.
Right.
But I have to say, the father of Austrian neutrality was also a conservative. It was Julius Raab. So
genau.
There was a conflict between Adenauer and Raab. So I had to mention this because you said there were all social Democrats.
Maybe we can do a program on Austria one day.
No. I know. The time is
so. No, that would be interesting one. We should do it one day.
But I said, yes. Europe, let me summarize, Europe have to think about concepts which go beyond this division. Otherwise, we will have this conflict
sanitaire. But it seems to me the atmosphere, the public atmosphere, it really is not conductive right now. Any politician who would even mention these things right now, they would, you know, they would hang him up, you know.
That's definitely...
This is a problem, isn't it? I mean, we have a situation where you had this massive propaganda campaign, you know, and it's interesting to me because, you know, Europeans in general, on the average, are much more, you know, conscious, aware, educated, have more information about the world than maybe American public has. So maybe one can understand if the Americans want to, you know, apply this propaganda to their own population because their own population is very ignorant about the world. But the Europeans don't seem to be, are not that ignorant. And yet we see this massive propaganda campaign still going on. The idea that somebody would come out and say, look, we need to talk to the Russians at some point. This is not in our favor. It seems to me this is almost an impossible thing to propose right now as a political figure or as a public figure.
Unfortunately, yes. But it might change if Europe will feel the effects of the war and if they will learn about the casualties. So they're not different than Americans. If you see casualties all the time and refugees and... It over time, if a war goes on for too long, it might change the attitude. But on a global level, because you talk about the European citizens, now we have this war situation, which is a very special situation. And in a war, you have always this with me or against me. You have this dichotomy. So there is no place for a complex, as we did, complex analysis.
So we have to start.
Right. But let's just mention one thing that was an... poll by the European Council on Foreign Relations, which was taken before the war already. But the question was, if there is a conflict between US and China, it didn't even ask military conflict, it only said conflict.
Right.
What options would you choose? Go with China, go with the US, or stay neutral? So 65 of the Europeans would say they rather would be stay neutral. Of course, they would not want to side with China, but they would not want to be drawn into a military conflict on the side of a conflict with the US, which is not their own.
Professor, I think we have come to a good conclusion, which is the Austrian model is the best model for all of Europe.
I would agree.
That would be the best model. So, Professor, we have about 5 minutes left. If you could please then, let's look into the future. We already began talking about in terms of conceptually what could happen, but let's make it a little bit more practical. So you're saying right now the situation is very polarized. It's very hard to begin these conversations in Europe, even though the majority of the people in Europe feel that this is not in their interest. Of course, we have also the winter coming up and this issue of gas and the issue of energy prices. We see in Italy there's already riots, people burning their energy bills in front of the city hall and threatening a boycott of paying their energy bills. We see in Germany a very strange thing happening, people going back to idea of using coal for fuel and going to the forest and cutting down the trees for the firewood. I'm simply saying these things because these are things that are actually happening. I don't want to, you know, exaggerate the issue, but it seems to me that this winter is going to be a very interesting winter in Europe because, as you said, the effects are going to be felt maybe in ways that still are not being felt, even though they are being felt. So if you could maybe give us some insight, give us your analysis and your views about this idea of having an alternative vision, a vision that's different than this Cold War and this idea of not having relations with Russia. If you could give us a little bit more practical, what you would suggest practically we should be doing maybe in the next 5, 6, 10 years for this to happen?
Yeah, I have to say, of course, it will be a difficult winter for Europe. It will be not that dramatic as some observers would see it. Of course, the reserves for gas and oil, 85%, they are full. But the problem is the price, because exactly. The Europeans are buying oil from gas from the U.S., from Norway, Netherlands, the democratic country of Azerbaijan, and
Algeria.
So and I don't want to be cynical now, but
yes, exactly.
It will be expensive, and the prices will be a problem. And we will have will have recovered after the pandemic. Now they will fall back in terms of unemployment. Some factories will close. Companies will close. So it will be very difficult. And the Europeans seem to be united in the sanctions against Russia. But if it comes to the energy discussion, of course, there are pledges that we are still united. But they're not that united, the Europeans. Mm-hmm. They have different interests, and you see it now if you look at the debate on the price cap on Russian gas. So Austria, for example, and others would say, no, that's not feasible. Other European countries right. would want to do it. So in practical reasons, there might be come out very different things. And the European Union might blame members and other members which mm-hmm. are not going along. It might be Hungary and Poland. Maybe it will change in Italy with a new right-wing government as well. Some member states will blame the Commission, and there will be always the excuse, we have to do it on a European level. So we have to have speak with one voice. That's not going to happen all the time. So because in foreign policy, of course...
Right. So, Professor, that's very interesting you mentioned this, because this brings me to maybe the gist of the whole, this the key to understanding a lot of things. We had this European integration process, and I remember you once mentioned the idea of these expectations not really meeting the reality. And in some ways, we maybe have... because we like to talk theoretically, both of us, in terms of our academic background, that maybe we have now come to the understanding that there is such a thing as national interests beyond what this idea of European common interest, that maybe there is going to be some sort of a, maybe not formally but informally, a split within the European Union.
We are back to another international relations theory. We have exactly. this functional reasons, that's integration
exactly,
theory.
Exactly.
And the European idea was based on this. So that means you have cooperation on the lower level, science, technology, economy, spill over to political and
right.
Security, and then common defense and common government. It worked to a certain level.
Exactly.
So it worked. But it does not go all the way. Common defense is no question right now. Common defense policy, yes. Cooperation, right. Strategic compass, everything. But it doesn't go to... Europe doesn't want a common commander, so who decides whether the soldiers are going to die.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
And not the common guy. And here the Europeans have to be realistic and say
exactly.
we have to can go to a certain level. And there can be multilateralism on this level, and the European Union can be active. And my favorite example is the GCPOA.
Right.
The GCPOA was after 2015 a masterpiece of multilateralism. But the idea is you have certain member states that can do something, and the European Union would support it. So you need not have the common consensus of all the states.
Right.
Otherwise, it's always an excuse.
Right.
So you can do this on a lower level, and some countries can do it, the opinion. So the GCPA would be a good example. We will see how it plays out.
Right.
But for the European Union, it's possible that the European Union can do something on a level beneath the common government, beneath
right.
the common voice.
I guess my question is this, Professor. Is it really, are these those Western European nations and elites who are pretty much fully invested in NATO and in the alliance with America, are they capable of accepting that a country like Hungary, like Poland, like Germany might have its own national interest vis-a-vis Russia as opposed to theirs? Maybe you could say, okay, Belgium, what does Belgium have to do with Russia? Okay, we can say that. But there are countries that really their national interest is not to be at war with Russia. I mean, is this something that, because this goes back to the idea of ideology, is the ideology so deep, this Atlanticism, this idea of that, you know, America is the way to go for Europe, particularly after World War II and the horrors of Nazism, the crimes that happened with communism and Stalinism that happened in Eastern Europe. Is Europe capable of having this diversity of interests and handling it?
Of course, the transatlantic bonds are very strong. Of course, right. We have NATO, but Europeans always think the Americans helped out in the First World War, Second World War, were the leading state during the Cold War against the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet Union. They closed their eyes during the Vietnam War. They closed their eyes already when we had the coup against Mossadegh. They closed their eyes.
They usually close their eyes when the Americans...
In Chile.
Exactly.
But there have been differences already during the Iraq War. You saw Germany and France. They were not really happy with the decision, and there was no UN Security Council authorization. So we should not discard the transatlantic bonds.
Right.
But what I do think, of course, European states might find out they have their own interests as well, especially when it comes to the use of force, use of violence. After all, the European Union considered itself as a peace union from the start.
The whole point was that there would be no war.
Right.
Exactly.
So I should go back. It will be a process, but it might be possible.
Professor Gärtner, we've come to the end of our time. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for our wonderful discussion that we had. I think we might have to do another one at some point, mm-hmm. maybe the next season.
I'll come back to Tehran soon.
And next time you're in Tehran, inshallah, we can have another discussion. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for the conversation.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Professor Gärtner? The US and NATO have once again successfully divided Europe and created a new Cold War against Russia by disregarding legitimate Russian strategic interests for decades and using any opportunity to provoke and humiliate Russia. Behavior which was criticized after the Cold War by none other than the father of Soviet containment policy, the late George Kennan, and which today is being criticized by none other than the still living Henry Kissinger. After NATO's humiliating defeat in its 20-year campaign in Afghanistan, this new Cold War and NATO expansion is a lifeline for the military-industrial complex in the United States, which requires permanent global war to justify its evil existence on this earth. Brainwashed Atlanticist European elites proudly reject the wishes of their own populations to proclaim their fidelity to NATO and their allegiance to the US, disregarding the real on-the-ground consequences of these policies for the daily lives of their own citizens. An unprecedented level of Russia-phobia and blatant in-your-face propaganda is sweeping the West, creating a suffocating atmosphere that gaslights and browbeats anybody who might dare to suggest that it is in Europe's real interest to have good relations with its massive neighbor, the Russian Federation, independent of what the US thinks of this. Once again, we come to understand that geopolitically, Europe is an American colony, physically and mentally occupied by one of the victors of World War II nearly 80 years ago. The Western rejection and isolation of Russia has been very good for Eurasian integration, the old nightmare of the British imperialists and their US inheritors, such as the late Zbigniew Brzezinski, creating a history-changing strategic alliance between the great Asian powers of Russia, China, and Iran in the global heartland. Of course, the old Anglo-American strategy is to separate Europe from Asia, to keep its European colony firmly in its own grip, and to divert Europe's wealth and resources towards its own military-industrial complex, depriving Europeans of the benefits of joining a new era in human history, the era of a strong and wealthy Eurasia. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time, on Insight.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. Stay tuned. In the past, there was an expression used at the time when people answered yes or positive. In Persian language, when a person answered yes to a request, the fast answer was, wait for his hardships too. This means that upon saying yes or answering positively, we must tolerate its hard conditions too. As one famous Persian calligrapher states, I used to practice 14 hours a day, so today you can enjoy my beautiful handwritings on the wall. Therefore, if you want to become a skillful painter, you must practice hard. You must avoid so many deeds that others do with their hands. Also, you must not carry heavy weights or do difficult tasks. This way, your power of hand and your talent is kept alive in you. Otherwise, you will lose all of your power. So, in order to reach to higher status, we must practice hard and bear the difficulties. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ranjbar. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is I.